Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Democrats in Congress can't quite figure out what to do about the war, but they have no such problem with recent revelations about medical care for veterans. There were more congressional hearings about Walter Reed Hospital today. President Bush made a speech about it, too. But is there an amount of money that can make things right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price. Mutual funds, IRAs, and college savings. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence. 1-877-T-ROWE-PRICE or TRowePrice.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday. It's the 6th of March today. You know, it must be nice to be the president. Let's say you've got a major problem that's getting terrible press. You need to make a speech to announce your blue ribbon commission. So you call up some people you know and ask if you can swing by. Sure, they say. And so President Bush spoke to the American Legion today. He announced former Senator and World War II veteran Bob Dole and former Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala will investigate the problems at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. But there was no mention of why the hospital wasn't ready for the surge in the first place. We got in touch with Gordon Adams to talk about that and how to fix it. He's a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. Mr. Adams, good to speak with you.
Yes, sir.
Is this a problem that the White House can fix with just money?
It's going to take two things to fix it. One may be a little bit of money or attention to the money. And the other is going to be dealing with the way the bureaucracy operates and some of the attitudes and personnel who are dealing with these medical issues down at the level of places like Walter Reed.
The president made a speech today in which he talked about how much he's increased the budget for military medical care. Is that money actually getting to where it needs to go?
Well, it's pretty clear that it's not. There are really two issues at Walter Reed. Issue number one is a maintenance issue. That is things like, you know, the paint peeling and the rats running through the building. That problem is not solely one of Walter Reed. It's a general problem for bases in the United States because the operations and maintenance money that generally would go to things like base maintenance gets sucked away regularly to deal with the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan and then doesn't get backfilled for some time. The other question, though, really is the question of bureaucracy. Do you have enough people? That's money. Are they the right people? Are they trained to run the process right? And do they have the right attitude about how we deal with the soldiers and the Marines that are going through this system?
Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan, who's the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said today that it's his opinion that this reflects a lack of war planning, that it goes back to not being ready for what was going to come.
I don't think they were ready, and that's, of course, a much bigger problem. At the beginning of this war, of course, the administration and the military assumed it would be short and sweet, and by the end of 2003, most of the Americans would be home and casualties would be very low. As a consequence, the system really was not beefed up and prepared to handle the workload it's got coming in. The VA system is swamped. The Walter Reed Hospital system is swamped, and there aren't enough people and enough quality people and the right attitude to process people through the system in a helpful and courteous way.
But we're 4 years into the war now, Mr. Adams.
Yeah, it has been. You would think after about a year or two of this that they would figure out in the Army this is going to be a real problem and we're going to have to beef up this system and deal with it. That's really a problem on the Army's shoulders.
Is it a question of the actual medical care or the apparatus for delivering that care?
It's not really so much a question of medical care as it is the problem of dealing with processing people through the system and out into the Veterans Administration system. The Veterans Hospital system, for example, was really improved over the last 10 or 15 years, but not ready for the kind of hundreds of thousands of caseloads that it's now taking in as a result of the people cycling through. And Walter Reed's been experiencing delays of things like 200 days, you know, essentially 6 months worth of time before they get somebody with serious wounds coming back from Iraq and being processed either into the VA or the retirement system.
Wasn't the Army talking about closing Walter Reed not too long ago?
They have, in fact, officially been earmarked for closure. The Base Closing Commission said Walter Reed will close. They're 3 or 4 years away from that being actually the case, and it's being closed. Congress is now taking a look at that and saying, well, gee, maybe we were premature in allowing the commission to make that kind of decision and agreeing to it. The problem that the Congress has is if they reverse a base closure commission decision on some place like Walter Reed, they're going to have every congressman and every installation from here to Hawaii coming in and saying, hey, save us too. We're desperately needed now that the situation has changed.
Gordon Adams at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Mr. Adams, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Elsewhere in Washington today, the Senate voted narrowly to give 45,000 airport security screeners the right to unionize. The White House is threatening a veto of that bill, but before they deal with that, senators will have to untangle another controversy over how to divvy up federal Homeland Security money. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Last May, the Department of Homeland Security announced grants for local anti-terrorism programs. And officials in New York City and Washington, D.C. were appalled when their own funding was slashed, while cities such as Louisville, Kentucky, and Omaha, Nebraska got 40% increases. Under the current formula, 60% of local grants go to states judged to be more at risk to a terror attack, with the rest distributed to all states equally. Illinois' Democratic Senator Barack Obama wants to send a bigger chunk to states more vulnerable to terrorism.
We increase the funding available to protect those places most at risk, and 40 states will receive either the same amount or an increase in the funding they need to better protect our borders, our ports, our railways, our subways, our chemical plants, and our firefighters, police officers, and EMTs.
But advocates for wider distribution of Homeland Security grants, such as Maine Republican Susan Collins, said terrorists can strike anywhere.
Who would have guessed that Portland, Maine, would have been the departure point for two of the hijackers on 9/11? Who would have guessed that four of the hijackers would train and live in Norman, Oklahoma?
The Senate is considering four different formulas for distributing the money, but regional squabbling threatens to derail plans by Senate leaders to finish work on the bill by the end of the week. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You could tell today was a much less stressful day in the global equity markets because we waited till 7 minutes into the show to get to them. Asian and European investors broke a week-long losing streak overnight. In New York, all three major indices closed up 1% or more. But that's not to say it was all clear sailing. There was a report out this morning on productivity. It's slowing, which means companies are getting less out of their workers. Hugh Johnson's the chief investment officer at Johnson Illington Advisors.
It really means that the cost of a unit of labor, a unit of output, is going higher. In other words, wage rates are going higher, becoming a little bit more difficult for companies to manage. And that's where the real problem is. It puts pressure on managements to increase prices, and that's not good news.
It was indeed a bounce today on Wall Street. Only question is, what kind? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's a tale of two CEOs, both of them effectively fired or at least eased out the door. John Brown's the outgoing CEO of the British oil giant BP. The company announced today Brown's total compensation package last year was 28% lower than a year earlier. BP's profits rose with higher oil prices, but ongoing safety and ethical problems have kept BP in regulatory crosshairs. Now, consider Bob Nardelli, former CEO of the American company Home Depot. He was asked to leave recently and given a $210 million going-away present. Commentator Nell Minow explains why the difference matters.
Excessive CEO compensation is not just an immaterial aberration to be written off as a tiny percentage of a company's balance sheet. It's a fundamental, systemic abuse that undermines the credibility of our capital markets. So the people we count on to provide us with capital through investments and loans will be less likely to want to give us their money. That means we'll have to offer more guarantees or more goods in exchange for their money. That increases the cost of capital, and it makes everything more expensive. And if capital becomes too dear, then we'll lose critical investors to other economies that tie pay to performance. The fundamental irony is that the very same people who claim that the free market is the most efficient mechanism for assigning value don't apply that test to their own pay packages. We should give shareholders an advisory vote. That would strike just the right balance. It's not the job of the shareholders to decide on the details of CEO pay. That requires a deep understanding of each company's strategy and risk factors. That's what the board is for. But shareholders could remind the board that it owes its loyalty to them, not the CEO. The UK adopted this rule 4 years ago, and you know what? The world didn't come to an end. There has been exactly one vote against a pay plan. The board revised the plan. It turns out that just the prospect of a no vote discourages excessive pay plans at many companies and leads to better communication on why any given pay plan isn't excessive. That's exactly how it should work. Shareholders want executives to earn a lot of money. They just don't want them to get a lot of money without earning it.
Nell Minow is the co-founder of The Corporate Library. Send us your thoughts when you get a minute. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. It's a big day in Vermont today. The first Tuesday in March is traditionally Town Meeting Day. Colchester residents are debating the value of the bookmobile. In Milton, voters will decide on $1.5 million bond for mold repair in the elementary school. People who live in Winooski will vote on a new community center. It all sounds a bit quaint, but for Vermonters, it's the way local politics have worked since the 1700s. Attendance at town meetings is down, though, and this exercise in a more intimate form of democracy is fading. John Dillon reports from Vermont Public Radio. A bill in the legislature hopes to revive the tradition.
Vermont State Senator Dick McCormick loves the ideal of the town meeting. For this one day, he says, every citizen becomes a legislator.
It's local, and it's direct democracy.
On town meeting day, people across the state gather to set town and school budgets, hire the road foreman, or buy a new snowplow. The problem is that the meetings are often held during the day when people have to work. McCormick says the institution is in danger of becoming a relic.
I think the question is, how serious are we about this? Is this really just Norman Rockwell picturesque, or is this in fact a form of government we take seriously?
McCormick has co-sponsored legislation that would require employers to provide an unpaid day off for town meeting. But a mandated day off triggers alarm bells for businesses, especially those in the service sector. Mike Bellier is spokesman for the Vermont Chamber of Commerce.
Our only concern would be a business that may have staffing issues.
But Bellier says employers could deal with the legislation since they already have to rearrange work schedules to accommodate vacations and personal days. There are, of course, other reasons for dwindling attendance at town meeting. Some people don't care to get involved in participatory democracy. Others just find town meetings, well, boring. In Montpelier, Vermont, I'm John Dillon for Marketplace.
We are hereby warned, got to show up in the morn. First Tuesday, town hall, 10 or so. Winter's on the wane, we've all gone insane. Let's while away the weather, kids in tow.
Thanks to the gang at Vermont Public Radio for sending us that song. It's called, appropriately enough, A Town Meeting Tune. It's by Vermont legend John Gailmore.
Down from the mountains, up from the dales, in from the woodlands, chock full of tales. Check out the neighbors, find out the news.
Coming up, computer crime gets organized.
The first time, somebody just gave me a call out of nowhere, saying they hold my resume in their hands, and they wanted to know if I'm interested in a job hacking into websites.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets regained their footing today. The Dow Industrials flew up 157 points, 1.3%, to finish at 12,207. The Nasdaq rose 44 points, just a tad under 2%, to close at 2385. The S&P 500 climbed 21 points, 1.5%, to end at 1395. Citigroup shored up 2.7% on its $10 billion bid for Japan's third largest security company, Nikko Cordial. Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers both ended nine-day losing streaks. Bear Stearns gained a bit more than 3%. Lehman Brothers gained 4.33%. Subprime mortgage lender New Century Financial recovered just a bit from yesterday's record plunge and cautiously padded up 10%. Dow stalwarts Alcoa, General Motors, IBM, and Altria Group each tanked up more than 2% today. Bonds slipped. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve Board reports on consumer credit for January. Citizens Against Government Waste releases its annual congressional pig book. And how long is your commute? Some of the roads out there are getting pretty cozy, in a too many cars on the highway kind of way. The organization Resources for the Future discusses national initiatives to manage traffic congestion. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know the type, right? People in your office who love making your life miserable. Maybe it's the boss who's never satisfied, or the coworker who loves pointing out your faults. The folks who are just real, well, you know the word. We just can't say it on the radio. Seven letters, starts with an A, ends in E. Author Bob Sutton says we should have a rule against them because they're not only bad for morale, they're bad for business. Bob Sutton, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Maybe we ought to set out the paradigm here. What is the rule?
So the rule is, quite simply, that you shouldn't allow people to get away with demeaning and de-energizing people. And when they do it, there should actually be consequences. So to give you a good concrete example, two organizations, Southwest Airlines is famous for hiring and firing for attitude. And if a pilot is nasty to a receptionist in the process of the interview, they won't get the job. And an even more concrete example is a firm in headquartered in San Mateo, California, that requires all new employees to sign a contract saying that they won't be a jerk.
On the face of it, it seems like a pretty reasonable idea that you want a workplace that just doesn't have all these kinds of bad people in it. But it's tougher to achieve than you might think.
There's a number of reasons. One is that we have, if you think about it, some cultural myths in our society, where we act as if good bosses are tough bosses and don't put any nonsense and, in fact, kick people around. And there's even research on something called the brilliant but cruel phenomenon, that if you say the same thing sort of with an extra personal insult attached to it, that you'll be given extra IQ points rather than saying it nice. So for your folks who watch The American Idol, if you've seen Simon Cowell, who almost always adds a personal insult, even when he says something nice, he's viewed as the smart one, while the other two, Paul and Randy, will tend to be nicer and say often virtually the same thing, but we think he's smarter. So there is part of this cultural myth where we think that people who are nastier are smarter when, in fact, they're not. They're just nasty.
Is there a sliding scale here? I mean, you know, if you work with somebody on a daily basis and you say, well, that's okay behavior, that's okay, boom, oh, right there, you're a jerk.
Well, no, from my perspective, the main distinction that I make is the difference between temporary and certified jerks. So to me, a temporary jerk, we're all capable when we're under stress or when around nasty people of being demeaning. It's somebody who is consistently nasty across sort of places and times. So to go into the domain of politics, John C. Bolton, who I guess is no longer the ambassador to the UN,
right.
The UN, but was for a while, in his hearings was described by subordinates as a kiss-up, kick-down sort of guy. Somebody who has that, if the congressional record is accurate, somebody who does that sort of thing consistently, to me, looks like a candidate for a certified jerk.
But, you know, one company's jerk is another company's, you know, leading revenue getter or star salesman or
right.
top producer.
Well, so to me, that's one of the things that one reason that I wrote this book is to hopefully get business and other organizations to question this notion that when somebody's a big star, if they're a big jerk, it's okay. And to give you an example, there's a case from a real company in the book of a star salesman named Ethan, who was one of the rainmakers for a Silicon Valley company. And they calculated the cost of the secretaries that he went through, his anger management training, the legal costs, the extra overtime he required people to work, and the cost was $160,000 for one jerk for 1 year. So sometimes the people who are the bullies and the creeps who demean people and push people around, they seem like they're worth it, but when you run the numbers, they're really not.
Bob Sutton's a professor of management science and engineering at Stanford University. His latest book is called The No Asshole Rule. Bob Sutton, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much, Guy.
You'd like to think the leading public companies in this country would be above simple name-calling, that they'd be focused on better product for consumers and higher profits for their shareholders. Alas, it's not always so. We bring you now the latest installment of Microsoft versus Google. Marketplace's Lisa Roth has more from New York.
Microsoft's Corporate Counsel for Copyright, Trademark, and Trade Secrets gave a speech in New York today. The venue, a meeting of the Association of American Publishers. Thomas Rubin's theme, what he called Google's cavalier attitude toward copyright. Rubin compared the two companies' approaches to scanning millions of books and making them available online. Should we nourish creativity, he asked, or choose the way that encourages companies simply to take the works of others? Guess who he thinks is nourishing creativity? Consultant Laura DiDio follows Microsoft.
Many people would argue that Microsoft, in fact, doesn't just have a glass house, it's cellophane. So it's even flimsier.
Of course, that probably didn't bother Rubin's audience much. The AAP filed one of several copyright infringement suits against Google. Max Levchin founded several Silicon Valley ventures. He says forget the squabbling.
As the time goes by, the lawyers will sort out who needs to pay whom how much.
But really, says the Yankee Group's DiDio, today's public casting of aspersions isn't about digital media anyway.
This is the high-tech version of American Gladiators. Both of these companies are locked in a struggle for the hearts, minds, and pocketbooks of not only their existing customer bases, but also potential customer bases.
Among other things, she says, Google's recent foray into the world of office software has its rival on edge. In New York, I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
Hundreds of law enforcement officials and computer security experts will be meeting at Kennesaw State University in Georgia in a couple of weeks. They'll be talking about the dark side of the computer revolution, computers as criminal tools. They make it oh so easy to target your money or your identity. And behind that rise in cybercrime is a sinister brand of entrepreneur, as Steve Tripoli reports from the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk.
A decade ago, the movie Hackers portrayed a bunch of cyber-hip teens who busted into corporate computers mostly to show off.
Yes, home run, okay.
Just showing off doesn't cut it anymore. Vincent Weaver of Symantec, which makes Norton antivirus software, says a far nastier group has now moved in.
Really, we saw a dramatic transition from the old hackers, virus writers era into the cybercrime era occurring the end of 2004 to early 2005. It was a very, very dramatic changeover.
These new bad guys saw big money in attacking computers. They want your personal information so they can rob you, or so they can pose as you and steal from someone else. Or maybe they want to hook up your computer to thousands of others in a cybercrime invasion army called a botnet. Weaver says this group's different in another way, too.
Many of them are entrepreneurs coming in.
Entrepreneurs without their own hacking skills. What they're about is building a business based on hacking. Dave Marcus of McAfee Labs, another antivirus firm, says organized crime groups worldwide are players. They and others recruit young geeks they find in coffee houses and other hangouts. But they're drafting another cohort, too, college students with more advanced tech skills.
And they look to them for a different reason. They're more looked to the university students to place them later on down the line in a company that they're going to need insider information on. They will look for a person who's in their second year or first year of college and actually sponsor their education.
These dark side recruiters also chase seasoned pros. Gadi Evron is a computer security expert with the Israeli firm Beyond Security. He says he's been recruited twice.
The first time, somebody just gave me a call out of nowhere, saying they hold my resume in their hands, and they wanted to know if I'm interested in a job hacking into websites.
Evron guessed that these callers were middlemen. He never found out who was behind them. But the next approach was more direct.
I was in a formal meeting with very impressive people, and they said, we are a global firm for private investigations, and we're interested in your help. And it became pretty clear over the conversation that they were speaking of industrial espionage.
Evron wouldn't name that company, but he says it's pretty clear both ends of these deals know they're breaking the law. And he says people with no special computer skills might be tricked into cybercrime.
You yourself, Steve, may get an email, for example, saying, hey, are you interested in work from home? Or some sort of a $75,000 a year job. The one thing they don't tell these people is that they'll be arrested in about a week or two.
These folks are being used to launder money. For a fee, they transfer stolen funds to Russia, China, or another cybercrime outpost, thinking it's a legitimate transfer. Then they get dumped. Their untraceable sponsors don't care if these so-called money mules are quickly busted.
Man, there's too many garbage files. I need more time.
In that decade-old movie, the fictional young hackers track down the evil computer virus and, of course, save the world.
They found it! They found it!
You should be so lucky in Real World 2007. Gadi Evron says most people don't realize how dangerous the Internet has become. Serious-looking websites and emails can be imposters. Celebrity websites, social sites like MySpace, and hot sites like one for this year's Super Bowl have all been booby-trapped. Bottom line, you need to have all your computer defenses up, and you need good ones, because there's no larger solution for fighting these new cybercrime entrepreneurs right now, and they know it. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we go. Today, news of Scooter Libby's conviction had been on the wires for barely 2 hours before a publisher announced he's putting out a book about the trial. Libby, former chief of staff to Vice President Dick Cheney, was convicted today of lying and obstruction of justice in the FBI investigation into the leak of a CIA operative's identity. The book will be called The United States versus I. Lewis Libby, available next month from Sterling Publishing's Union Square Press. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, Wall Street and the world turned things around. The Dow rose 157 points, 1.3%. The Nasdaq picked up 44 points, nearly 2%. The S&P 500 gained 21 points. That's about a percent and a half there. Thanks to Miguel Macias on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, the president's headed to South America later this week. Some think there's more to it than meets the eye.
This is a Chavez containment trip. Chavez is driving the agenda, he's capturing the headlines, and obviously that is causing a lot of concern in Washington.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.